This is The Annex, a sociology podcast. I'm Joseph Cohen from Queens College in the City University of New York. For more, visit theannexpodcast.com. Turn to John Eason. John is an associate professor of sociology at Texas A&M and the author of Big House on the Prairie, Rise of the Rural Ghetto and Prison Proliferation from the University of Chicago Press. Thank you very much for joining us, John.
Thank you so much for having me, Joe. I appreciate being part of this panel.
Oh, we should have people with such great titles all the time. It just perfectly encapsulates your thesis.
It does.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about your work?
So we were leaving a discussion of why we came into sociology. And I actually, I was a community organizer. So I was a practicing Marxist, right? And I had read a lot of Marx in undergrad. When I left undergrad, I wanted to go out and change the world. Mm-hmm. I thought there were a lot of things that needed fixing. Having grown up at the time I did, I finished college about 1994. So I was very much into activism. When I went to University of Illinois, I was involved with a number of protests there around racial discrimination, redistribution of resources on campus. So when I came out, I actually had a degree in urban and regional planning. I wanted to work in housing because of, at that time, the plan for transformation was just getting underway to take down a lot of the housing developments in Chicago. And I was worried about how people would be redispersed, right? And you can see a number of studies, you know, the Moving to Opportunity and the rest of those studies that have sort of tracked how that went about. But I didn't know if the academy was the best place to start. So I started in community organizing. I was closing drug houses. We were very concerned with changing the South Side. In fact, the South Side of Chicago, the organization I worked for, was a church-based community organization called the Alliance of Congregations Transforming the South Side, or ACTS, straight out of straight biblical reference. And during one of the marches, because we closed a lot of drug houses, during one of the marches, a leader, one of my church leaders, said, basically, we're sending our young black kids downstate for white, for poor rural whites to get jobs, right? And there was all of this talk of this so-called prison industrial complex. Fun fact, I was actually organizing in a neighborhood that Mary Petillo was studying for her first book, Black Picket Fences. And I was actually a subject in that study, but I was super paranoid back then as a practicing Marxist. I didn't want to be identified in any way. So I'm outing myself now because this also leads into my trajectory or how I get into grad school. So I leave organizing and come into the University of Chicago, and I'm studying to get a master's in public policy. I'm offered an internship in the mayor's office. From there, I'm offered a job. And that summer, after my first year working on my MPP, I started looking at the social program. I met a few professors, Richard Taub, Rob Sampson. And I was thinking, oh, maybe I'll give this a try. I had been a soc minor in undergrad. And I thought there wasn't enough thinking of how to improve communities, right? Organizing, the type of organizing I was doing needed to change. The model needed to change. So I was thinking, oh, I'll go get a PhD. I'll look at social change. I'll be able to help improve communities that way. And I've sort of been lost in the academy since. The first mistake I made was you know, going to University of Chicago, if that's the case. You really don't go back into the community from that. Not too many people.
So it's
people
not just
have,
where fun goes to die, it's where community engagement goes to die.
Yes, it's where, well, unless you just, so a recent, a good friend of mine, Rami is a MacArthur Genius Award winner. He was a urban sociologist, ethnographer, did his dissertation in the Middle East, and then he went back to community organizing. He just left the academy, never went in, unless you just go a completely different route, because you get sidetracked and you get into much of like what we were talking about to start this podcast, the world of the academy. You have to know who your audience is. You get caught up in these things. So I shouldn't say the mistake I made. It was great coming out of Chicago and trying to temper some of my incredibly Marxist tendencies with, you know, other social theorists like Weber, and understanding how the so-called prison industrial complex. In my book, I rethink that as a penal industrial complex, something that David Garland refers to as a new iron cage, where justification for prison buildings have been replaced with the quote, the system taking on a life of its own, giving rise to adaptive behavior, serving secondary interests. So that's, you know, that's sort of where my book is situated, where it takes off from. I started the questions while I was organizing, and I think I spent years collecting not just qualitative but also quantitative data and trying to figure out how best to tackle this problem, where we've gone from 511 to 1,663 prisons and 30 plus years. Everyone talks about the supply side of mass imprisonment, right? We incarcerate over 2 million people annually. Mm-hmm. And what do you think is going to happen in these rural communities? Because most prisons are built in those communities. When you try and take their prisons, right? They're not going to give them up.
Is the problem the number of prisons, or is the problem the number of prisoners? Because, and I make that distinction in the sense, my understanding is that large prisons tend to have much more severe gang problems and otherwise be much more unpleasant places to serve your time than small prisons. And so, like, if I could, let's say I had a magic wand and I could keep the prison population as is, or maybe cut it 10%. But double the number of prisons, so basically each prisoner's in a smaller prison. I'd do that in a heartbeat, just so that people could serve their time without getting, being forced to join gangs to survive.
Well, that's so. Those are two separate problems. So the problem you asked, and actually you brought up a third, what's going on inside the prison. So the problem of too many prisoners. Yes, we have far too many prisoners in the U.S. 2 million people, more than 2 million people locked up annually, with a disproportionate number of them being nonviolent drug offenders, has been talked about repeatedly. Right, that's a huge problem.
Are a majority of the other nonviolent drug offenders? I thought if you in the federal system, you have a very high proportion are drug offenders, but 90% of prisoners are state and local, and in that, I thought it was something like a third. Right. Are drug offenders, and most of them are property or violent crime.
Many are property and violent, but it doesn't. I should check my parse this out correctly. Even if a third of them are nonviolent drug offenders, that's too many people in a system that's not going to get them better. Right? We need to have better alternatives. The prisons themselves are a whole other problem. Mm-hmm. Because the prison, if you look within the institution, I think that's what you were hinting at, Gabriel, what's happening inside the institution, we really haven't cared much about what goes on inside of prisons since the 80s. That means people who work for the prisons, their job is increasingly difficult. And we've also, my work points towards a bigger problem. I think a bigger problem in the sense that, you know, are there too many prisons, or have we just created jobs that are connected to a system that we don't know the future of, right? So we have 450,000 corrections officers in this country. There's all of this talk about privatization, but most of them are not private. And that's the big problem. We have a huge political economy built up around prison building. And I think that's something I'm trying to shine the light on it. As you go to, if we were able to reduce the number of prisoners on the supply side, if we were able to reduce the number of prisoners, you're still going to have a fight with these communities that are predominantly rural fighting to keep those prisons. So that's we've set ourselves up for another battle. And this wasn't we didn't think about this as we built all of these prisons to house prisoners. We didn't consider these things. And that's what my work is pointing to.
And so part of what you're saying is there are these perverse incentives, actually, to continue to if not build prisons, then to at least maintain the number of beds that we currently have.
There's incredibly perverse incentives, and they complicate race and class in incredibly counterintuitive ways. So the first thing I found on my rabbit hole into the academy was that places. So we believe, when I came into grad school, I believed that, oh, these are going to be all white places that get prisons, right? Because the motto coming out of the Midwest is that prison towns are overwhelmingly white. But what my first quantitative paper shows in the research that I had found a few years prior to even publishing it, was that as you increase the percent Black and Latino, the probability in a town, as you increase the percent Black and Latino increases in a town, the probability of getting a prison increases. There is a optimal point for percent Blacks, so around 60-65% Black. Then if you're too Black and too poor, actually you can't get a prison, right? It's tougher to get a prison if you're too Black and too poor. But that was very shocking to me, because I had this this view of prison building from just a straight racial and economic exploitation view, structurally deterministic, like it's going to be poor white places that get these. But, you know, the data, the analyses I did pointed towards something different. And once I got on the ground and interviewed people in Forest City, Arkansas, I was even more shocked with the black middlemen, or Black elite, or race leaders, if you will, from Drake and Caton. They were fully in support of the prison coming. That was shocking to me, including the head of the NAACP.
Well, what's their argument? Can you just how do they justify this?
The easy answer is for all of this, people say, why would you move your family? Why would you go write this book? I can tell you why. It's all about jobs. Well, they actually, it wasn't just about jobs. It was about maintaining the image of the town. So these were people who, these both Black and white leaders in this town, these are the people that could have left. Karen Kafalas calls some of these people boomerangs, right? They leave and come back, or they end up planting themselves there. There's four different typologies in Karen Kafalas' book on rural communities. And some of these people had left and came back. Some were just there, but they were more professional. And they thought it was their job as the leaders in this community to save the image of the community. So, and they thought the prison could save the image of the community. So to think about that, you know, the question I asked originally is what caused the shift from not in my backyard to please in my backyard, the shift from NIMBY to PEMBY in rural communities. And the question you have to ask after that is, have you seen my backyard? So if a town wants a prison, you have to ask, what does their backyard look like? If they want a prison to improve their reputation, you really have to say what's going on in these places. And these are places that are marred by stigma and other things that ruin their reputation. So they thought the prison could improve their reputation. And this is even the Black leaders. They talked about the prison saving their town because their town, some of them, one of them in particular said he didn't want his town to end up like Gary, Indiana. Mm.
Yeah. So basically what you're saying is that in some places are like, so I, in reading your book, stigma actually is I think one of the key things, right? Yes. Operating throughout in your argument. And so you're saying that some towns' reputations are so marked by stigma that actually having a prison in your town, which for many places would be like, oh no, that's like the height of stigma. They're just like, bring it on.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. which is very counterintuitive, and I didn't expect it at all.
So I want to ask again about the political economy. And you were talking about like how building the prison creates a constituency for the prison and would resist efforts to take it down. So I'm a Californian, and I've spent most of my life in California. I live here now. And here, you know, one of the biggest political forces in the state is the California State Prison Guards Union. And I remember, right, I graduated high school in 1995, so I was reading the newspapers in the 90s as we had the scale-up to mass incarceration. And in the state of California, a lot of this happens through ballot initiative, where, you know, some organized activist group can get a law put on the ballot as direct democracy and have it passed. And these very often represent powerful organized constituencies like the teachers union or the prison guards union. And so a lot of the plebiscites that led to an increase in mass incarceration, such as three strikes, were directly sponsored by the prison guards unions. So if you have any doubts about that, let me know, because I'm just saying this is like a casual observer of the issue and you've looked into it more carefully. Yeah.
No, that's I think that so the prison guard union had to build up. Josh Page's work really looks at this, right? So he looks at the California corrections officers. There are more corrections officers in California than there are prisoners in Illinois. Mm-hmm. There are 50,000. My last check about 4 years ago or so, there's 50,000 corrections officers and about 45,000 people imprisoned in Illinois about 5 years ago. So if you think about that base, right? I mean, the teachers union has been manipulated by the corrections officers union because they've, in many respects, they'll vote against their own interests, and you know things will get cut for teachers and corrections officers. They tend to keep their jobs, so they're a strong political force. But there's also these communities where these prisons are built, right? And this isn't just about California. So Rebecca Thorpe, she's a political scientist at University of Washington. She has some research showing that rural communities that have prisons also oppose any legislation that would reduce mass incarceration. So not only do you have these unions lobbying, in California, you know, you have California is an exceptional case. And I know we pay a lot of attention to California, but Oklahoma has built more prisons than California. And the South has built more prisons than any other region. And the South, by and large, is a right-to-work space. So the union isn't going to work the same way. So the political economy behind prison building, I think, is very diverse. And we're just starting to understand it. But in the case of California, you're right, Gabe. You're right, Gabriel. This is the scenario you put forth. They built up, the union was built up through prison building, and they've also lobbied to build more prisons.
I just wanted to build on what you were saying about Oklahoma, because if I'm correct, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think Oklahoma actually, like the rate of women being incarcerated in Oklahoma is, I think, high. It's like higher than anywhere else in the country, or it's one of the highest in the country. And I think it's one, another one of those possible examples of, you know, we need to feed the machine, right? We actually don't want to get rid of these prisons, right? It's a means of economic growth, if you will, right? And so then you end up having to find more supply for the prisons. So I don't know. I'm just putting it out there.
I agree with that, but I think at a certain point there's, and I really have to, I'm starting to dig in this for a second book project, because I'm really retracing the prison boom using quantitative data and just instead of just a case study, like I did for my first book. So I have every prison geocoded into a U.S. census place or town and the date the prison opened. So I'm really resketching both the causes and consequences of the prison boom. I don't have a catchy title exactly for this book yet, but it's something along those lines, or that's what it's examining. It won't be something along those lines necessarily.
Are you able to give us a preview of any interesting findings, or we're not holding you to anything, but...
We've made a huge deal of racial exploitation and economic exploitation being the reason for prison building, but I think it's occurring at a level that we don't typically think of. So, or it's occurring in a way we don't typically think of, and we've made these ties between mass incarceration and Jim Crow, or mass incarceration and slavery. I have some preliminary analysis where I'm looking at census data from 1860 and, you know, where there were large slave holdings, and looking at counties where prisons were built as a predictor for counties where prisons are built. Okay, that makes sense, right? There's some correlation there. Looking at where during Jim Crow, where lynchings took place, right? There's some correlation explaining prison building, but the stuff I'm really digging into now, the analysis I'm really trying to tease out is, how does concentrated disadvantage, or what I call the rural ghetto, the concentration, you know, concentrated poverty, residential segregation, within a neighborhood, right, in a rural community, how does that predict prison building? And I think that's the real key. Instead of just looking at a corollary over time, we can look at a direct cause of prison building. And I think this is the way I'm testing my case study, my ethnographic case study. I'm using quantitative data to test if the rural ghetto predicts prison building. And that, I think, speaks to racial and economic exploitation at a different level, where it's not just, okay, we're going to build the prison because it gives us jobs and economic stability, but it's linked to broader structural things that are occurring in these communities.
So I was thinking, or this might be something you already know, or it could be something you could test as you get into the quantitative analysis, but part of my reason bringing up the California Prison Guards Union and our plebiscites is, in some ways, it's easy for the guards to get their political interests served because we have this plebiscite. It's very easy to get a ballot initiative on the ballot in California, and that might very well be why we have such intense mass incarceration, more than, say, Texas or, like you said, Illinois. But I'm also wondering, what about states that don't have... a plebiscite system. or at least they do, but it's harder to get things on the ballot. In those states, do you tend to see a different structure? Is it just that, you know, state senators who have a prison in their district will tend to be more in favor of it? So what is the political mechanism and how does it work based on the institutions of the state?
That's a great question. I actually have data looking mm-hmm. at just the House and the upper and lower House and the gubernatorial governorship by party. That's why I mentioned Rebecca Thorpe. I'm actually expanding my work into looking at the politics, especially at the state level, in determining this. The local level is going to be, mm-hmm. so there's prison siting, which I define as either the feds or the state trying to find a place to put a prison. And then there's prison placement, which is the local political economy where the leaders mm-hmm. within a town are trying to attract a prison. So that's how they get built, because there are places where the NIMBY, not in my backyard, threshold would be too high. There are towns that don't want prisons. You do have to kind of want a prison, and you have to make it known and lobby for it. So that dynamic process is very political. And this plebiscite system you're mentioning, I think California, like for so many, this is why I didn't want to study. Sure. I didn't want to do a case study of California, Texas, Georgia, or Florida. Those places mm-hmm. are so unique. I think California is so unique because of the plebiscite system. I don't think mm-hmm. it works that way anywhere else mm-hmm. in the country. I think that local, yeah. it's like a good old boy network. And when I mean good old boy, I literally mean it's male dominated and they're all old and they're all connected in some way. And so you have to have a certain level of social capital to pull a prison into your town. So that means people that their connections all the way up to Bill Clinton with the building of the Forest City Federal Correctional Facility. They got the idea in Forest City actually from Alice Walton, who was trying to build a private prison, and they were approached by people on her behalf to build a prison. They thought, a private prison, we're too good for a private prison. We can do better than that. So they took the idea and ran with it and started talking with their congressmen and the like, and states and U.S. senator, their congressmen and U.S. senators, about getting a prison yeah. in Arkansas. So it's a very different political process.
Well, it just occurred to me as you were speaking that there's actually two separate issues. One issue is how many prisoners should the state as a whole have? And that's mostly what the plebiscite system in California affects, right? So if you pass a third strike law, that effectively says we're going to end up having more prisoners, or at least we're going to keep the prisoners we have for much longer, which longitudinally means we'll have more prisoners. But it doesn't say that they're going to go in this rural town mm-hmm. or that rural town. You know, you still have the issue of where do right. they go, and do we want them or do we not want them at the local level? So there's almost like two aspects of the political economy of incarceration is, you know, do we have more or fewer prisoners? Do we ratchet up or ratchet down incarceration? And then do we put them here or do we put them there?
There, yes, that's exactly right. So the prison boom is often equate it with mass imprisonment or mass incarceration. And what I really try and what I do, I even have a glossary in my book where I'm separating out these terms. So the prison boom for me is the move from 511 to 1663. Prison proliferation is about the mm-hmm. widespread dispersion of prison building. And it has, you know, the logic of prison building has, when you start to look at the numbers of prisoners, so there are some mm-hmm. states that have similar numbers of prisoners and completely different prison building regimes. So I think at one point in time, North Carolina and New Jersey had similar numbers of prisoners, but North Carolina had far, maybe twice as many prisons. So there's a different logic within the state around prison siting. right, in North Carolina versus New Jersey. And we've only begun to scratch the surface of the different logics of mass incarceration at the state level. We've mapped some of these trends, right? But we really don't have an explanation, good explanations for the wide variation in state mass incarceration.
You've been listening to The Annex, a sociology podcast. For more information, visit theannexpodcast.com. Music is by Lena Orsa. Our production team included Anika Chowdhury and Liseth Moreno. On behalf of the Annex team, I'm Joe Cohen. Thanks for listening.